new yet familiar face on the other side of the ocean. Jim, welcome. And welcome to everybody in Norwalk.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
We're here to discuss to have an educational session on impairment. Who is going to teal?
I'll kick off. So today we will discuss paper, or any questions obviously as well, on paper 5A on impairment, and if time allows, any other questions relating to the other papers that were posted. So if we start with paper 5A, the objective of the impairment model is that lifetime expected credit losses are recognized for all financial instruments that have significantly increased in credit risk since initial recognition. This assessment should take into account the best available information, including forward-looking information that affects credit risk. Respondents to our proposal and field participants said that they don't have updated information on retail products at an individual exposure level before loans become delinquent or before other borrower-specific factors occur, such as, for example, restructurings. Because entities don't have more forward-looking information on the individual exposure level, the Basel Committee of Banking Supervision and other respondents to our proposal were concerned that in practice institutions will resort to using the 30 days rebuttable presumption as the primary indicator without considering whether other more forward-looking factors are present that indicate an increase in credit risk on a portfolio level. Unfortunately, that's what our fieldwork and many respondents to our proposals showed. It showed that many respondents understood our proposal to mean that in practice, they could apply the 30 days past due rebuttal presumption to assess significant increase in credit risk, even if more forward-looking information is available. This paper therefore considers how to ensure that the impairment model captures significant increase in credit risk on a timely basis, even if it is not identified on an individual exposure level yet. The paper describes two situations that result in significant increase in credit risks. They may not be captured on a timely basis. That is issue A and issue B in the paper. Issue A addresses significant increase in credit risk because of the crystallization of the initial expectations. That's discussed in paragraph 24 and until 26. Issue A considers situation in which default expectations arise as initially expected on a portfolio level, but where that significant increase in credit risk cannot be identified on an individual exposure level before the instrument becomes delinquent. This is best illustrated through an example such on page 11 and 12 of the board paper. Talks about an entity that originates 100 loans that are considered homogeneous at origination. The entity's initial expectation is that 5 loans out of the 100 loans will default by maturity. No significant payments are made before maturity. The example shows that while significant deterioration occurs much earlier than maturity, because of the payment profile, it might not be evident in delinquencies until much later. So relying on delinquency alone would delay the recognition of significant deterioration. In such a situation, a portfolio-based assessment is therefore necessary to capture the significant increase in credit risk on a timely basis. In contrast to issue A, issue B addresses increase in credit risk as a result of worsening in expectation and not based on the initial expectations. That's in paragraph 39 and 40. So in other words, it considers situation where significant increase in credit risk occurs because of changes in initial expectations. So if we continue from the example before, a change in a credit risk factor now occurs. So for example, an actual or an expected increase in the unemployment rate occurs. So now the entity estimates that 8 instead of 5 out of the 100 loans will ultimately default. Like issue A, the effect may, however, not be identifiable at an exposure level until much later when a delinquency arises. For both issue A and issue B, the paper discusses possible ways to do a portfolio assessment as well as its challenges. At a minimum, the staff think that it is necessary to clarify that the objective of the impairment model is to recognize lifetime expected credit losses on all financial instruments for which there is a significant increase in credit risk, and that forward-looking information that is available needs to be considered. In other words, clarify the following 2 points. An entity must use all reasonable supportable information, including forward-looking information that is available without undue cost or effort. So an entity cannot rely only on delinquency information to assess significant increase in credit risk. The other point is to clarify that the impairment model is not limited to identifying significant increase in credit risk where it is evident on an individual exposure level. A portfolio assessment may be necessary. The alternatives the board could consider are in paragraph 58, which are alternative A, to clarify the proposal on significant increase in credit risk, as I just explained. Alternative B is to clarify the proposals and prescribe methods to address issue A and issue B. Or alternative C is to clarify the proposals and provide illustrative examples to reflect the intention of the proposals. The staff recommends alternative C. So with this, I open for questions and discussions on paper 5A.
Beryl?
This is somewhere between a statement and a question. The objective always of the original, of the exposure draft was to identify where circumstances where significant deterioration had occurred. It was also accepting, in my understanding of it, that from time to time you could use portfolio measurements where that would approximate the outcome. Looking at what you've got in alternative A and alternative B, it seems to me that that is just applying those principles. It's applying the recognition of significant deterioration through a portfolio-based calculation methodology. Based on what we heard from the field tests and from what we heard from feedback, it didn't seem like people always got to that answer. But I guess the first question for me would be, did anybody get to that answer, or did people really find it very difficult to read that into what we've written? And maybe the second one was that when we talked to people through the process of the field test, did any of them then see how they could come with the answers that we've sort of proposed in this paper?
So I would say, so in the field work, there was a very limited number of participants that used more forward-looking information than just delinquency. We had people who basically were able to break it down to the individual exposure level, also on retail products. So they had PD-based models, and they looked at the macroeconomic factors, and they were able to draw links to individual exposures depending on what the risk of the individual borrowers were. We had other respondents who recognized that also comes through some of the comment letters, that respondents recognize that actually we need to take much forward-looking information into account, but we don't know how. because we don't manage it on an individual exposure level. So there was, and then we had then also a small number of people to which it felt like it wasn't clear.
You mean we don't manage it on a portfolio level? Is that what you?
They manage it on a portfolio
basis,
level,
not on an individual basis,
not on an individual basis. So that's why they.
Well, then they should be able to make a portfolio analysis, shouldn't they?
Well, they were concerned that this would then mean they have to move the entire portfolio to lifetime expected losses, even though maybe only a portion is affected. And they are saying because we don't know exactly which individual loans within that portfolio is actually affected, and we don't think it's right to move the entire portfolio, we are not sure how we should implement the proposal.
So you're seriously saying that these people cannot... These banks cannot make an analysis that when unemployment goes up by 2% or there's an interest rate hike of 2%, that they cannot make an estimation roughly what part of their portfolio might become very risky.
Maybe I could add to that. I think it's, I mean, partly it's misunderstanding, partly it's they need time to build systems to do some of this, but I think that there's a difference between knowing that over the portfolio there might be an increase in risk because of something like unemployment and then working out what the effect is on your expected credit loss calculation. So from going from the sort of macroeconomic effect to the specific effect can be tricky to do. But I think partly what this board paper is trying to do is to confirm that even if you need to use estimation techniques to make an assessment of what you think the overall effect is on the portfolio, that's okay, that's what we intend. And so I think it's partly that comfort,
because
that's the expectation.
I think my concern here was that that's what I had thought was always there. Yeah. But I think to an extent the exchange between Hans and Joanna maybe answered the question. I don't think there are banks out there who don't have the ability to estimate it. I think it was then this concern about whole portfolio versus...
Yeah.
Part of portfolio.
Yeah.
So, and if we go through A, B, and C, your three alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of them, you're going to clarify what's meant, so that's okay. So the only difference is whether we prescribe a method in B,
mm-hmm.
or whether we give examples or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I could go for A or C, depending whether A is clear enough without examples, mm-hmm. which it may well be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I agree not, I don't think prescribing methods
is
the way to go.
Yeah, we, from a staff perspective, we didn't think, or we didn't recommend alternative B because of the differences in the information that is available, the systems, the robustness of how people can apply the methods, different methods, so being more accurate or doing more portfolio top-down assessment as we describe it. It really depends on how much information is available, so we didn't feel that we can prescribe a specific method.
Mary?
Yeah, in terms of C and what kind of examples, I think very often we think of using examples of here's how it would work. Would it be worthwhile considering an example of here's how it should not work? And the reason I suggest that is one of the messages that came through to me reading the paper is that some people might read the 30-day backstop as actually a safe harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you were pointing out, I think it was in this paper, that 30 days is not good if you have a product where the loans tend to be at the end, and so therefore that 30 days is not a valid test for significant deterioration. So maybe we do at least include an example of when 30 days would not be appropriate,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to focusing on how many examples can we come up with of what you should do.
Mm-hmm.
It also goes to show how dangerous rebuttable presumptions are.
Right.
Before you know, they are taken as acceptable methods or the preferred methods, especially when they're easy, and they don't force you to take losses at the right time. So, I thought that the standard as we had written it the decisions as we have taken them were perfectly clear, but obviously we have to be clear, and I think Mary's suggestion to give some clear examples where a rebuttable presumption, use of the rebuttable presumption would be clearly wrong, would be very good. And also we have to make clear that it is really something that you only can use if all the other options have been exhausted or are not there. Changwu?
Yes, maybe the relation to the managed suggestion. Even though I'm wondering, you know, even we are giving some good example to how to identify those three individual, maybe some split loans. I'm just, you know, maybe still we are taking the approach B in the example of approach three, because we have to show our kind of method to identify those 5% individual loans.
Yeah, I guess we could in the example obviously show acceptable methods, but I think the point between alternative B and alternative C is that we wouldn't prescribe a particular method. Because I guess you could also look at it from the perspective and say, well, I want more consistency, so I only get consistency if people apply the same method. And so you might want to go for alternative B, even though I'm not sure that's really realistic in practice to prescribe it.
Stephen?
Just on the, is this... was this originally intended? And I'm not so sure that this was fully spelled out in what we had. And I think you could have read the ED as very much being an individual assessment at the individual credit level. Or you assessed it for a whole portfolio or a segment of a portfolio and you moved everything in that portfolio over. So I think this is an enhancement to the model, and I think it is a change. I think some people did read it the way that Daryl suggested, that we met one recently and said, well, we always thought it was this, but I think the majority probably didn't. Yeah. I wanted to ask a question, though, on paragraph 32 and the comment that's in there. It says that although the approach described here is different from the incurred but not reported IBNR approach in IS 39, there's some similarities and the like. It seems to me that it is very, very similar to the approach in IS 39. In IS 39, to my mind, both A and B are there. Paragraph 59, I think, is issue B, and AG 90, I think, is issue A. And the AG 90 example is credit cards and people dying and incurred losses being the result. And the example that we've got in here is very similar. It's just people losing their jobs. So I think it's almost identical. In the footnote, you describe on page 14 the difference between IBNR and IS 39 and what we're describing here. I'm not sure that your description of IBNR is exactly right, because that sort of points to a loss emergence period. I know that's the sort of the colloquial way in which we describe IBNR, but to my mind, the IBNR is issues A and B. Now, the difference... Yeah. Of course, is that in IBNR we're dealing with incurred losses, here we're dealing with deterioration.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
a fundamental difference in terms of so the information that's being used. I'm talking about...
That's why we don't want to confuse...
I know. I'm talking about the concepts and the mechanics of it. I accept that it is fundamentally different in outcome.
Yeah.
I also think that we're dealing with forecasts and expectations, whereas IBNR deals with historical loss experience. So IBNR is backward-looking, and it's incurred losses, loss events. We are forward-looking, expectations, take into account changes in expectations, and it is credit deterioration. So there's a fundamental difference between the two. But I'm just trying to understand the mechanics. Even though you're applying to different things, the mechanics seem to me to be similar, because the examples that you're using in the paper are very similar to the examples which are in IS 39, but just apply to different things, as in deterioration versus incurred loss. Am I wrong in that assessment?
I think the... how did you call it? The... sorry, the approach or the
mechanics.
So from a mechanical point of view, or the way you could apply statistical methods, it is similar. But as you said, there is a fundamental difference, and that difference is that we are now assessing whether there's significant deterioration that has occurred but hasn't been identified. So we are looking at that rather than the loss event, and as you said, the backwards looking. To have that backward look. And in the outreach that we've done on paper 5A, banks also said that they see this as being fundamentally different to the IBNR approach for that reason.
I think that's good.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I think perhaps one difference is when we've been talking to some people about how they might try and capture this increase in significant credit risk on a where they can't see it at an individual obligor sort of delinquency type basis quickly enough. They've been trying to think of ways where they can identify sort of sub-portfolios, specific factors in sub-portfolios that might be able to give you a better estimate of which parts of the portfolio are affected. I think the bottom-up approach that is used in the paper. And I think, personally, where people have that information, that feels to me like a more robust way of trying to identify it than perhaps more of the top-downish sort of approach, which I think is more what people have done with IBNR. And so, in a sense, we sort of would like to encourage that type of more granular.
It's a more forward-looking, more robust,
yeah, a bit more
version
specifically
of the collective
applied
assessment, yeah, that we have previously. So, is it fair to say that at the individual credit level, the model we're producing is more forward-looking, more responsive, but also on a collective basis, it's more forward-looking and more responsive? Both the existing model has individual and collective assessment, and the model we're developing has individual and collective assessment, but in both cases, more forward-looking.
Yes.
So it's physically impossible for the allowance to go down.
Yes.
Shouldn't.
I have a question, Hans.
I guess Jana or anybody in the staff, going back to the issue of whether or not this principle that you're introducing was in fact, you know, in the ED or not, my interpretation was that it always was. And the reason is, and clarify this for me because I think it's an important point, is that assuming there's no evidence of deterioration in a portfolio or an individual asset, embedded in an expected loss model, in your historical information is an expected loss. So I would assume at a minimum, under an expected loss model, that one would recognize at a minimum the historical losses, okay, unless there's evidence to the contrary that my historical loss rate is not indicative of, in fact, what my losses are.
Over what period?
Mm-hmm. That's an open question.
I think you're describing a lifetime loss.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that if you were to have a portfolio of 100 items, and you historically expected 5 to default, at the end of that period of time, that duration of that portfolio, would it be permissible not to recognize any loss if there was no evidence of deterioration?
But it's too late, then.
I don't disagree whether it's too late or not.
At the end of the term, they will have occurred.
Exactly.
So what about at the end of period one?
So that's the question. We have to decide timing. But my question is I don't think there should be any debate that in an expected loss model, embedded, implicit in your historical loss expectation is that you're going to record or recognize at least that amount unless there's evidence to the contrary.
Sure.
But
you agree?
Yeah. Okay. All right.
The question becomes when do you book it?
Significant deterioration. That's when you recognize.
But if you only recognize when there's significant deterioration, you're always going to be too late, right?
No.
Then you're a lifetime loss, right?
Yeah.
Then you have to book it up front.
No, you don't have to. Yeah. You don't have to.
When do you book it then?
Well, there could be, for example, the mechanics that you were talking about before applicable to an IBNR approach could be a way to do it, a statistical loss method.
Yeah. It's going to be anchored on something, and what we're proposing is historical, to anchor it on deterioration.
Historical loss emergence approach.
The answer is it should be fully provided for at the time significant deterioration occurs.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
The question is how quickly can
how
you identify
you do?
That's
how
right.
Do you do that?
That's right.
Yeah. Martin?
Yeah, I'm looking at the alternatives which is proposed in this paper, and I'd really recommend that we should go alternative C, because I think alternative A is not sufficient. Because I'm also with Steve, I think some people have really interpreted that, saying okay, we should have this, if it is a significant deterioration on an individual loan level or instrument level, and I think we should, in alternative C, really give examples how you can do it on a portfolio level. I think that will help them and will clarify the issue. No. I think it's not sufficient only if we, say, give examples by specific products, because I think the issue is more, is not product specific, it is more how could you do it if you don't have the information on an individual instrument level, and how do you can do it on a portfolio level instead of distinguishing between different products.
Yeah, I think the examples will also help, because in the conversations that we have, most people thought about issue B. There were not many people who thought about issue A, but issue A obviously is particularly relevant if you have these back-ended payment obligations. So that's why providing examples will additionally help to clarify our intention rather than just going to clarify the principle.
Now, Giel, question to you. In the field work, was some of the field work done on the basis of these mistaken assumptions?
No. So what the field work did is what Jana alluded to. So let's say they did the 30 days, but then some of the field participants were the ones that raised this issue of, if I can't identify it on an individual level, but I'm able to estimate this portfolio, what am I doing? Am I moving a portion of the portfolio?
Yes.
Because I felt the wording didn't get them to that. Does that mean the entire portfolio, which was not appropriate, or do they keep it at the transaction level but acknowledge something is missing? So I think the advantage of this paper is that it's starting to address that concern which the field participants came and said.
Okay, now, but in the end, did they do it, let's say, in the C way or the way that you think?
I don't think they could have. Huh? They couldn't, Hans. They didn't have the information yet. So some of them applied it in a way based on the information they had available, but acknowledged there was a gap, which is something they need to think about during the implementation period to get ready for the application of the standard.
What I'm getting at, if that is the case, that although they showed quite a significant increase in provisioning, that
yep.
increase was probably too low
yeah.
compared
yes.
to what the yeah. clarified model
yes.
will do.
Yes, correct.
I think many of them felt yeah. that the stage one allowance replaced their collective assessment
yeah.
previously.
That means that where these preliminary results were statistically they're not significant. I mean, that you cannot take them as an average for the whole sector, but roughly they showed a doubling of provisioning. It's probably going to be more.
Yeah, and that's why when we've been looking at the results, it's been very important to us to understand how people have applied the model, so that we know how much weight to put on the numbers and which ones are closer to how we think the model would actually be applied versus not. So that was critical for our understanding of the feedback.
And I think almost what two things was that it definitely doing this kind of assessment, they felt because we asked them to do the test throughout an economic cycle, they felt that would allow to be more reactive and more responsive to what's happening. And I think even some of the participants actually said they think improving their models to do this on a more granular level is going to be beneficial for them.
So. Well, that yeah. I mean, it's nice to hear, but I find it quite unbelievable. Okay.
Yep.
Patrick, did you have another question?
Question. If we are to provide examples such as example one in this fact pattern, are we going to give the model solution? What happened to this fact pattern in terms of allowance? Or do we leave it just to illustrate the issue but not give the way the model would work?
my personal preference would be to note that we would like this to be captured. I think it's hard for us to prescribe how, because it's going to depend on the information they have available.
But
yeah, the facts that we describe here,
they know, and there will be no change, and it will happen as expected, that 5% will be delinquent at the end, or somewhere between now and the end. So they have to provide for 5% of this portfolio, obviously. Right, question when? And do we give the answer together with the example of when to do it? Day one, normal solution, over time, or is it captured by the 12 months allowance? And that's...
It's the more difficult issue to resolve.
I know. But if I'm
first, fortunately, the second one is much more important.
Of course, yes. Although it has also, no, it has a question on day one as well, and you will have to capture the further deterioration. But still, you have the issue same as.
You've captured exactly what I was trying to say.
Yeah. So I think it's good to have examples, but you know where, how people are going to use them is my next question.
I think, Philippe, what you're saying is, let's say if you expect five to go bad and those losses on the five will be, let's say, 50. Your question is, if we know, you know, if we have perfect foresight and it's going to be exactly right. If we know on day one that 50 goes bad.
We're lucky.
Should we have the 50 on day one, which is the lifetime?
Yes.
Does it make sense, and this is kind of what was coming through in the 12-month compromise, to say it's some portion of the 50, and let's say that's
why we have
35.
Yes, maybe.
But we need to be careful, because our anchor is still significant deterioration.
Exactly.
So we still want people to be basing it on their assessment of when significant deterioration occurs. Otherwise, we do end up with lifetime
data. But in example one, and there is no deterioration at the portfolio level, because the portfolio will behave exactly as expected.
You don't know where it is.
It is within
the... Let me finish.
Not at a portfolio level, an individual level.
At the portfolio level, it will behave as expected. There is no deterioration between now and the end of this story. It will deteriorate at the individual contract level. We just don't know which one. Okay, so we cannot capture it by assumption at the individual level, because there is no system in place. So when you are faced with this fact pattern, the question is, yes, you know you will lose 50, but how and when you provide it? And the example begs the question. Right?
But listen, Philippe, don't forget this is exactly why we have the first bucket to begin with.
No, that's fine. The question is now, shall we illustrate how the first bucket will capture it?
I think we should give an example and saying, for example, in your past experience, if you have this situation maybe of these five loans which go bad, two were in the past going bad after 2 years, and maybe the three after 3 years. And if that is your expected statistical behavior, you don't have any other information, so you can use that. It is a kind of example that we could give and help them to doing that.
And I think the key is to illustrate that it's before delinquency that you need to recognize your lifetime loss on the portion of the book. That's the key I think we want to show.
I think Martin's point is right, is that you will have statistical, you have the ability, remember what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a statistical inference at a portfolio level of what we believe is happening in the underlying. That statistical inference will tell you about timing. Okay. In the total absence of timing, if you're taking something like in your example, you've got unemployment. There's no reason to believe that unemployment happens in bunches. It happens over the period of the 5 years. So you could recognize it evenly over the period of 5 years. But obviously, if you've got information that tells you more about the portfolio, that it's more likely to happen earlier or later, you would use whatever that statistical information
is. That is what you are doing if you have to do a judgment based on a portfolio level. If you don't have the individual information, you're looking what is the behavior in the past and look and use
any portfolio measurement, and we do it in insurance, we do it in other places, you simply apply that.
But therefore, really, I think it is really important that we go to alternative C and give examples, because otherwise we will ongoing have this confusion.
Okay. Is this it for this paper?
Yeah. B? Okay.
Okay. Next paper.
We still have time, so yeah, maybe we should. Well, paper 5C and paper 5D, if you have any questions,
On those papers.
Yeah.
We're only going to discuss this one.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to make sure that we discuss this one and any questions you have on the other ones.
would be helpful.
So, I think if we just first consider paper 5C, which deals with the measurement objective for the assets that are in stage 1, and whether we do have a loss allowance for those assets and whether we don't, I don't know if you've got any questions on that paper you would like to clarify.
Questions or comments?
Comments are also welcome.
Educational session.
Exactly, so I'll hold them.
No?
Oh, maybe one question, and I think it's an idea that comes from another paper, but I think it's applicable in here. Is it likely, and it kind of goes back to the example we were just discussing, that if you're using that we would start with historical experience as our anchor, and really our struggle in terms of measurement objective is figuring out what to do with the further off periods for which we are trying to estimate what the impacts of expected changes in macroeconomic cycles are.
I think the anchor of our expected losses would be your historic experience, and you would start with that, adjusting it for what your current expectations are and your forward-looking information that you are using. And it will also take into account your experience on certain products and the way losses arise over the life of those instruments. So when you calculate your probability of a default happening, or when you assess your significant increases in credit risk, you would need to take into account the specific factors and the information for that product so that you can do that over the life of the instrument. But it will start with what you've got and what you've experienced in the past and how you can adjust that going forward for your current expectations. Any other comments?
Okay, thank you.
Then I think we have one more paper.
Yeah.
5D, which considers the definition of default and whether we should define default in our final requirements or maintain the position we had in the exposure draft of not defining default at all. Do you have any questions or comments on that paper? No.
Well, again, the danger of rebuttable presumptions.
Yeah.
And especially when they stretch to 180 days, makes me very uncomfortable. But I know there are new thoughts about this.
Yeah, I had the same point because I thought, okay, why is it 180 days and why is it not 90 days, for example? And based also what I think on Basel is, I think they have 90 days and I don't really saw a basis to have 180 days, and I would prefer more going to 90 days. This is rebuttable presumptions. And also because, to define it only on default of payment, because maybe that was from the beginning clear, but that means really for this kind of loans, which really have in the first year not any payment, that we don't have any 12 months expected loss for them. And that is where I firstly struggled a little bit with, but I think I don't have also any other solutions to that. But it must be clear for this kind of loans, which have really not any payment interest or repayment of principal, we will not have any 12 months expected loss for that. If we would define it as only as...
And I think just to clarify, so... That what you've just described would be alternative A, one in the paper of saying defining default just by reference to non-payment or payment default only. And that's one of the reasons the staff is not recommending that approach, because we don't think it would be appropriate for all kinds of products in all situations, and it is not consistent with how entities manage or define default for credit risk management purposes. The way we thought about approach 3, which is the rebuttable presumption, and whether that is 180 days or 90 days, I mean, we can talk about that. But the way the rebuttable presumption is meant to apply is as a backstop. So if an entity uses a definition of default for credit risk management purposes or for regulatory purposes that is more responsive and it identifies defaults at an earlier point or on a more qualitative basis, so it's not just based on payment default, but it also considers qualitative factors like technical defaults or bankruptcy, that you would apply that definition of default, and you would only really have to rebut the presumption if your definition of default is later than, let's say, 180 days or 90 days if we decide to do it.
But we would require that. We would say if you have a more sophisticated definition of default, other than then you should use that, and only
this example might also be helpful.
Okay.
Mary?
We had a couple points. One is, you know, maybe today or maybe when we have the discussion, if you could explain the source of what, you know, what 180 and what other sources would be. I don't remember it being explained in here. So that's one thing. But a second is, do we think it would be appropriate to have an entity to have a single definition of default, almost like an accounting policy disclosure, across a range of products in regions, or is the point that we actually think that there might be different definitions of default for different types of products, and we may have to try and bring out that idea too, that it isn't an accounting policy election?
And I think it is safe to say that different products have different points of definition,
mm-hmm.
and it all depends on how the assets are managed, for example. So if you've got a retail portfolio that's only managed on a delinquency basis, then default may only be defined as payment or non-payment, so payment default, because you don't have any other information to indicate sooner than that default may occur. Which in contrast, if you think about a corporate exposure, for example, where you've got technical default clauses and you've got more updated borrower-specific information that can indicate this, you know, the unlikeliness of a borrower to pay future payments even before he has actually missed the payment. So, you know, different products do have different definitions, and, you know, we can definitely bring that out.
Okay. And would we only have qualitative considerations for products that have covenants? So, you know, maybe not for credit card, but yes, for commercial loan, or would we conceivably also have qualitative considerations for all products?
I think you can have qualitative factors or indicators for all kinds of products. I think it depends on the information, the content, and the availability of information at the entity. So you could, for a mortgage or a credit card, you could have cross-default factors, or you know, you can still use distressed debt restructurings, or all of those qualitative factors, which is not payment default. It just depends on how much information is available, whether they can apply that or not.
PK.
I think, Rihanna, a couple of things that were touched by Martin and Mary. I actually personally believe that defining a default is a pretty onerous task. The reason is that, like somebody mentioned, if you have covenants, there are technical defaults that are considered to be defaults. The fact that you are anchoring to 180 days past due somehow should be very clearly articulated that it is not a quantitative, because first of all, 180 days looks too long, but I think this, several people mentioned that. But even if you mention 90 days or 120 days or whatever it is, I think it's very important to not to belittle different defaults and just only talk about non-payment default, because all of them, whether they are quantitative or qualitative, have the same import as far as a default definition is considered. And they can translate into a non-payment eventually.
Yes.
So I think those flavors should be coming through quite clearly, and with the different portfolio, different types of instruments and different types of retail, non-retail, corporate, non-corporate. I think the task of this has to be very finely tuned such that we don't do it, because I'm a little worried we have a 30-day which created a lot of confusion. Now we are putting 90-day or 180-day, and we need to explain what that 30-day means, what this 90 or 180-day means, and I think that needs to be done carefully. So,
Aaron?
In the spirit of the education session, I'm not going to say what I think at this stage, but I did want to ask one quick question on this. If alternative three is a rebuttable presumption as a backstop, and we choose not to define what default actually is, how do you rebut it?
If you have a product where it makes sense for some reason for more than 180 days to be the definition of default, so if you're in a jurisdiction where people never pay on time, but it doesn't mean they ultimately default.
The problem is
extreme, I guess.
We had a bank many years ago in South Africa, you may remember this, that defined default as legal certainty accounting. So only at the point that a final judgment had been issued.
Yeah, and I don't think we mean what they define it as. I think it means to be economically real, if I can describe it that way.
My concern is that if they did define it as that, and we haven't defined default, what is to stop them saying, well, they have rebutted it, because that is how they have defined default?
I think the idea would be, and it hasn't necessarily worked perfectly, so I'm a bit nervous using it as the example, but in the same way that we use the 30-day past due as the rebuttable presumption for significant increase in credit risk, but you could rebut it if you could show that there wasn't really a relationship between that 30-day past due and a change in your probability of default that was significant. It would be similarly a sort of economic concept that we'd be looking for as a basis for rebuttal. But I agree it is a bit... I find it hard to imagine where you have more than 180 days, frankly.
And I think the concern for me is that with the 30-day, and we've already had some concern with the 30 days, the 30 days we had a principle to anchor it around, which was that you would illustrate that even though it was 30 days, it was not significant deterioration. On default, we're not actually defining default, so we don't have a principle to anchor it around. We're simply saying you can rebut it if you want to. And it just feels to me like it leaves the question open.
I guess it would have to be linked to whether you ultimately recover or not, or some concept
can
like
I
that.
Just make one comment? Because
I think I may have failed in not giving my view, though.
Can I just make a comment? I forgot in my... to think, what disclosures do you plan to have around this to alleviate some of the concerns that Daryl is raising? Because if you can't define, how can you break it? So I think that it warrants some amount of thought there.
I think, the exposure draft already proposes to require entities to disclose how they've defined default and how they've applied it. But I think now is still a bit early to decide exactly what disclosures we want to put in addition to what's already in the exposure draft. So when we consider the whole disclosure package at one of the future meetings, we will definitely include this as part of that consideration.
Okay.
Stephen?
Can I just test my understanding of why this matters in the first place? Seems to me that it affects the stage one allowance, and that how you define default will affect how big that allowance is, and it potentially could affect the timing of the transfer to stage two. In terms of the stage one allowance, am I right in saying that if default is defined as 180 days past due, let us say, and significant deterioration is 1 day past due, am I right in saying that the stage one allowance is actually only 6 months, not 12 months?
Yes, so it is 6 months worth of defaults, but it is still...
So the definition of default will have a significant impact on how big that allowance is.
And
in terms of the transfer to stage two, my understanding is it has very little impact, because after all, we're not actually requiring people to look at PD as such to assess deterioration. And I think you said on page 7 in a footnote, key principle is the risk of default rather than a specific PD. So how we define default isn't really very important for the transfer to stage 2, because it's based upon increases in credit risk.
Yes, so it has some effect. it has a, you know, some effect, because if you define default as 90 days or as 30 days, if you want to be really proactive, then there's a bigger probability that someone will reach 30 days than there is, let's say, if default was defined as 180 days, that someone would reach 180 days. So a lot of people will get to 30 days and they may cure back.
No, but it's the change in the number, though, isn't it?
But, it depends how your cure behaves, whether when your PD increases, it's consistent, your cure rate is consistent, or whether that's inconsistent.
Okay, so if I define it as 30 days instead of 180 days, do I get a bigger stage 2 allowance or smaller stage 2 allowance?
Bigger stage.
I think you could get it could be more responsive. Because I think you could have more things that would increase in their risk of being 30 days past due, but then come back again. So I think it's going to be more volatile.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question to follow up on Stephen's first question? If we define default as anything other than what the market has been using, i.e. the rating agencies and others, how then would companies be able to use that data, those PDs, for purposes of making their 12-month or even lifetime amounts, because they'd be completely disconnected?
Yeah, yes. And that was one of the reasons we didn't want to define default in any specific way, whether it be qualitative or quantitative, because it could be inconsistent.
But I think it would have to be anchored in the same way that the market is using it if you're going to rely on those statistics for your purposes.
Yes, but there is a difference between what the rating agencies use as default and how some of the regulators define default versus...
I agree with you, but if you're going to use rating agency PDs in your systems, I think you have to use the rating agency's definition of PD.
And if you don't have rating agency PDs in your system?
Well, it's widely available. You can get it pretty easily.
You are right, Pat. I think that to the extent they can align the definition with what they've got information that fits with, it's going to be easier for them. We could come up with something new, and then they'll have to get new statistics to get it to work.
That would be more onerous, I think.
But today that the banks do sometimes use different default definitions for their internal risk management purposes than for reg purposes.
Yeah, for their own bank loans, you're right.
They may have two systems already, but I'm not sure if we want to make them introduce a third.
But if we allow them to choose, then we have lack of comparability.
I absolutely agree with that. I think it's very important because of stage one that we improve the clarity personally on the default definition.
We go.
Can I ask one question to be clear whether we are proposing? My understanding is if we choose alternative 3, we will still start with alternative 2. I'm right?
I'm sorry? Can you just repeat?
No, if we choose the alternative 3 means have a 90-day or 180-day rebuttable assumption, we will still start with the qualitative description of what the default means. Otherwise, you know, I will feel, you know, Darrow's concern is right.
I think the way...
It's a combination of...
Yes. So it will be a combination of approach 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could, you know, if that's what you want to consider, we can consider that. But that's...
Patricia?
Well, some of this discussion has confused me, so just to clarify in my mind, is there a relationship between how you define default and the loss given default? In other words, if it's 30 days is your default, is the loss given default smaller than if you're...
Yes, the answer is yes.
Okay.
But it's not a perfect relationship, which is what we found in the feedback on the ED.
Okay.
And that wasn't the point I was making with my 6-month comment.
Okay, then I missed the... point of your comment.
If you define deterioration as one day past due, then anything that's past due at the end of the period is in stage 2.
Right.
And if default is 180 days past due, then for the purpose of calculating stage 1, nothing can default in the next 6 months.
Right.
Because nothing can get to 180 days past due until 6 months have gone. So therefore, you only get 6 months worth of things coming into stage 1. That was my point. So it wasn't to do with the relationship between the PD and the LGD.
Okay.
you would be in favor of 365 days?
Yeah.
The reason I'm pointing it out is because I'm demonstrating a problem with bracket one, but we'll come to that.
He's very careful. It's not 365, 366.
Unless you were to disconnect the definition from
That's
PD
why
rates.
I would agree with me.
It was a leading question.
A very basic point of clarification. I just wanted to confirm that when we talk about a rebuttable presumption in approach three, my understanding is that this would be a presumption that's rebutted at the entity accounting policy level rather than on an individual instrument by instrument. So if we had a rebuttable presumption of X days, whatever X is, it means that the entity Daryl was talking about in South Africa that said, here's my definition of default, would rebut it universally for the products covered by that definition, as opposed to each instrument as it hit 180 being assessed and decided this is or isn't default. So it's an entity specific for all their products.
If you mean universal by particular product,
yes,
then yes,
that's what I meant.
But not by entity. Yeah.
Right, okay. I meant within an entity for each
product type in a particular jurisdiction, even particularly, but
as opposed to for everything that trips, whatever the trigger is, stop them once it trips that, decide whether this is yay or nay default. Yeah.
Okay. No more questions. Okay, that brings us to the end of the board meeting of today. Thank you. Have a nice day in Norwalk.
You too.